Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 80.
The Master and His Disciples. Where do we actually pick up their trail in this chapter?
Well, we join them just after they've left the Bhikkhu Kingdom.
Right. And it was quite an emotional departure, wasn't it? The king and the people escorting them for miles.
Yeah, for 20 li, the text says. That's what, about 6 miles? They really didn't want to see them go. It shows the impact they had.
Definitely. And then the mood shifts pretty quickly.
It does. From that human farewell right into the natural world, they're traveling at the winter's end and spring's peak.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, lovely descriptions of wildflowers and mountain trees, a beautiful and fragrant scene. It's a reminder that even on this incredibly tough quest, there are these moments of beauty, right? Little breaks.
But that peace doesn't last long, does it?
Not at all. Almost immediately, bam, a high and steep mountain appears.
And Tang Monk's reaction is predictable.
Oh, yeah. Instant fear. He's asking, like, is there even a safe path here? You can just hear the anxiety.
But Wukong, Sun Wukong, he has a very different take.
Completely different. Wukong's response is immediate, sharp, and actually quite funny. He basically says, the mountain doesn't block the path. The path goes through the mountain. Simple as that.
Huh. Very pragmatic.
Totally. And he even teases the master, calls him a prince sitting in a well, basically saying, you know, you're being naive or sheltered.
Okay, fair enough. But Tang Monk pushes back. All right. He's worried about
monsters and demons. Yeah. He's learned from hard experience. This isn't his first scary mountain.
And Zhu Baji. What's his contribution here?
Baji chimes in with his usual, maybe slightly too cheerful. Don't worry, we're close to the Western Heaven. It'll be peaceful now.
Right. Wishful thinking, perhaps?
You could say that. It's quite the mix of reactions, isn't it? Fear, pragmatism, maybe unfounded optimism.
So how do they actually get over the mountain?
Well, Wukong, being Wukong, doesn't waste time. He finds an excellent path on a cliff face.
Okay.
And then you see this really nice bit of teamwork. Baji carries the luggage. Sha Wujing leads the horse.
Making sure Tang Monk is okay in his card saddle.
Exactly. It's a quick moment, but it shows how they function as a unit, you know? Each playing their part, despite all the arguments and different personalities.
And the description of the mountain itself is just, wow.
Isn't it so evocative?
Cloud mist covers the peaks. Streams flow in the ravines. Sheer cliffs. Steep precipices.
Dense vines and plants. It really paints a picture.
And this bit. Thousands of shores compete in beauty, like arrayed halberds. 10,000 valleys contend in flow. What stands out to you there?
For me, it's that sense of active, almost competitive nature. Competing, contending. It's not just pretty, it's dynamic, maybe even a bit intimidating in its grandeur. Like, the landscape itself is part of the challenge.
Yeah, I get that. But even with this amazing scenery, Tang Monk feels something else, doesn't he?
He does. A wave of homesickness hits him. He's listening to the birdsong, and suddenly it just triggers his deep longing for home.
It's quite a vulnerable moment.
It really is. And he expresses it in this poem, or maybe it's more of a lament.
Can you share a bit of that?
Sure. He says something like, I received the imperial decree. 15 days after Lantern Festival, I left the Eastern Land, separating from the Tang Emperor. Having traversed 12 peaks of Wushan, when will I see the emperor again? It's not just missing home comforts. It's missing his emperor, his duty, the life he left. It really highlights the personal cost of this whole thing.
Heavy stuff. And how does Wukong react to this moment of vulnerability?
Predictably Wukong. He's completely blunt. Basically tells him, you think of home too much, that's not very monk-like.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then he throws in a proverb. If you seek wealth and honor, you must put in hard work. Essentially, stop complaining and focus on the goal. No room for feelings here.
But Tang Monk's doubt lingers. He asks, where is this Western Heaven Road? Like, are we even going the right way?
Exactly. And that's when Baji pipes up again.
Let me guess. Something helpful.
Huh? Not exactly. He makes this cynical joke, suggesting maybe Buddha moved the scriptures because he didn't want them to be taken.
Oh, Baji. Always find the humor. Or maybe just an excuse to stop.
Pretty much. He's a character.
So Wukong's blunt, Baji's cynical.
What about Sha Wujing? How does he handle this? Sha Wujing, he's the steady one. He tells Baji, essentially, stop talking nonsense. Just follow our big brother Wukong. Keep walking, we'll get there eventually.
The voice of reason and persistence.
Exactly. He's the anchor. And if you think about it, these different reactions, they kind of show the different ways you might cope with a really long, uncertain, difficult journey, right? You need the drive, maybe some humor, but also that quiet endurance.
That's a great point. So they keep moving, but then they hit another obstacle. And this one feels different.
Very different. A deep black pine forest. And Tang Monk's reaction is immediate wariness, much stronger than his fear of the mountain.
Why the difference, do you think?
Well, he says it himself. He uses a proverb, if you don't believe in straightness, you must guard against unkindness. He senses something wrong, something deceptive about this place.
And he notes it's deeper and darker than any other forest they've seen.
Right. He says none are as deep and far as this one. This isn't just a physical challenge. It feels like a moral or spiritual one is coming. The danger feels sneakier.
And the description of the forest backs that up, doesn't it? It sounds truly oppressive.
Oh, completely. East and west, densely arranged, north and south in rows. It sounds unnatural, like a trap.
Dense thorns intertwine. Vines intertwine with kudzu, making travel difficult. It sounds almost impossible to get through.
Exactly, like a maze designed to stop you. And then there's the bit about losing track of time. Living half a year, you lose track of months and days, walking several light. You can't see the Big Dipper.
That's incredibly disorienting.
Yeah.
Like the forest itself warps reality.
Precisely. And then you get the details about the trees, ancient, 1,000-year-old, 10,000-year-old. It adds this weight of time, of something ancient and maybe malevolent.
And the animals. It starts almost whimsical, but turns dark fast.
It does. Mina birds mimic speech. Thrushes can even read scriptures.
That's right.
Interesting. But then immediately, tigers wagtails, tigers gnash teeth, old foxes and badgers disguise as ladies, ancient wolves roar.
Whoa, disguise as ladies?
Yeah.
That's classic Journey to the West danger, illusion, and trickery.
Spot on. And the final warning is chilling. Even a powerful heavenly king, someone known for fighting demons, would lose his soul here.
So this is clearly more than just trees. It's a place of deep illusion, potent danger, maybe a test of their very souls.
I think that's exactly right. It's like an archetypal dark wood, a psychological space designed to confuse them, break their spirit, make them forget their quest.
Yet, despite all this, Wukong just plows ahead.
Yep. Unfazed, gets out his iron staff, clears a path. Business as usual for him, it seems.
And after half a day, Tang Monk needs a break. Understandable. He asks Wukong to go find some food, some alms.
Right. Seems like a normal pause in the journey. Wukong agrees, leaps up on a somersault cloud.
And this is where something really interesting happens, right? While he's up there.
Yes. He looks back down at his master resting in that dark, dangerous forest.
Yeah.
And what does he see?
Tell us.
Auspicious clouds float. Propitious mists linger right over Tang Monk. Signs of immense good fortune and spiritual protection.
Even in the middle of that awful forest.
Even there. And this is Wukong's big aha moment. He realizes, or maybe fully accepts, his master's true identity. The Golden Cicada Elder.
Buddha's former disciple, destined for greatness.
Exactly. He sees the inherent holiness and the destined success of the mission, despite the immediate danger.
And this triggers a whole internal monologue from Wukong.
It does. A really fascinating one. He says, good, good. Not about the forest, but about his master, about this realization.
And then he starts thinking about his own past.
Right. He contrasts his current situation with his former glory. 500 years ago, I caused havoc in heaven. He remembers being the great sage equal to heaven, fighting dragons, erasing his name from the book of death.
He remembers the power, the rebellion, the golden armor, the magic staff, all of it. That great sage is still in there.
Absolutely. But then he pivots. He reflects on his current state. Acting small and bowing low, being a disciple.
A big change from causing havoc in heaven.
A huge change.
Huh?
And he connects it directly to Tang Monk. He believes that by helping his master succeed, by getting him back to the East with the scriptures, he will achieve his own positive result.
His own enlightenment. So his obedience isn't just about the magic headband forcing him. It's tied to his own ultimate fate.
Precisely. It's a moment of profound self-awareness. He sees the bigger picture, his own path intertwined with his master's.
But this deep reflective moment, it doesn't last.
No, it's shattered almost immediately.
What does he see?
While still up in the air, he spots black tea, this dark, malevolent energy bubbling up from the south near the forest.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he instantly knows it's evil. And crucially, he notes that his companions, Tang Monk and the others, don't give off black eye. So this is definitely something external, something hostile.
So the danger Tang Monk sensed is actually manifesting.
It seems so. Wukong stays up there watching, described as unsure. The brief moment of clarity and reflection is over. Danger is imminent. Tripitaka, the monk, he's meditating, alone in a deep forest.
Right, setting the scene. Quiet, contemplative.
And then suddenly he hears this cry, save me! Really desperate sounding.
The hook.
So he follows the sound and finds this woman. She's bound to a tree.
In a pretty horrific way, too.
Yeah, her upper half tied with vines, lower half actually buried in the soil.
Grim stuff.
And the text goes into detail about her beauty, her peach cheeks flowing with tears.
The beauty that sinks fish and makes geese fall. Classic descriptions.
And her starry eyes, full of sorrow, having the appearance that closes the moon and shames flowers. I mean, they really lay it on thick.
And that raises a key question, doesn't it? Why so specific about her looks?
Yeah.
It's not just, background description. It feels central to the whole thing, to her deception.
How so?
Well, Tripitaka, even though he's this devout monk, the text explicitly says he has meat-eyed mortal vision.
Meaning he sees like a regular person.
Exactly. He can't see her true nature. He sees the surface, the beautiful, suffering woman. He can't perceive the demon underneath. That beauty is the bait and the trap.
And boy, does he fall for it. The woman tells this incredibly detailed, really heartbreaking story.
Oh, yeah. She lays it all out.
Says she's from a poor country, nearby, good parents, the whole deal.
Plausible deniability.
She says she was with her family for King Ming, that's the ancestor worship festival,
Right.
when bandits attacked. Her family got away, but she was captured because she was young and scared.
It's all the right notes for sympathy.
And then she adds this layer about the bandit leaders, the great king, the second king, others, all wanting her.
Creating conflict among the bad guys to explain why she was left behind.
Right. They started arguing. She says like 70 or 80 families of them. So they just tied her up and left her there.
Convenient.
She claims she's been there 5 days and nights. She's close to death, pleading with Tripitaka, save my life, promising she'll be grateful forever.
And she's crying the whole time. Tears like rain, the text says.
Exactly. Just selling it completely.
And if you connect this to the bigger picture of the novel, it's such a classic setup.
You see this kind of thing a lot.
Oh, constantly. The demon exploiting human virtue. In this case, Tripitaka's defining trait, his immense compassion. She knows exactly which buttons to push.
And it works. Tripitaka is genuinely moved. The text says he starts crying too.
Wow. He really feels for her.
So he calls for his disciples. Pigsy and Sandy show up.
And Pigsy, ever the comedian.
Hears his master crying and jokes that Tripitaka must have found a relative.
Classic Pigsy, always ready with a quip, even when things look serious. Maybe especially then.
So just as Pigsy starts to untie the woman, this is where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
Sun Wukong Monkey, he'd been off trying to find food, flying back empty-handed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And from midair, he senses something's wrong. He sees this thick black key, like a black mist.
The demonic energy.
Yeah, covering the auspicious light that should be there. It's a dead giveaway for him.
So Wukong immediately knows what's up. He sees the truth.
Instantly rushes back down. This contrast is huge, right? His spiritual perception versus Tripitaka's mortal sight.
Absolutely core to their dynamic. So what does Wukong do?
He doesn't mess around, grabs Pigsy by the ear, throws him down.
Whoa. Forceful.
And just declares flat out she's a demon, says it's a trick.
Does he give any justification?
Oh yeah, he says something really chilling actually. He says it's a business I've done before, a method for eating human flesh.
Yikes. So he's seen this exact kind of setup. He knows the playbook.
You'd think that would be enough, right?
Yeah.
Especially given Wukong's track record saving Tripitaka from exactly these kinds of illusions. But Tripitaka scolds him, calls Wukong a naughty monkey for talking nonsense.
Unbelievable.
He actually questions how Wukong could possibly know she's a demon when she looks so pitiful.
It's that meat-eyed mortal vision again. He's just completely stuck on the appearance.
And then the conflict just ramps up because Pigsy jumps in.
Oh, Pigsy, what does he add?
He tells Tripitaka basically, don't trust this monkey, calls him the horse groomer monkey.
Ooh, a low blow. Referencing Wukong's less glamorous past job in heaven.
Yeah, totally dismissive. Pigsy claims the woman's just a local.
Undermining Wukong's insight.
And then he makes this really serious accusation. He suggests Wukong wants them to leave so he can do clever things with the woman himself.
Wow. So Pigsy's implying Wukong is the one with impure motives, driven by lust.
Pretty much, it's a wild accusation.
And this whole dynamic is just so critical, isn't it? Pigsy, maybe because of his own, less refined nature or just lack of insight.
Or maybe he's slightly tempted himself.
Could be.
Hmm.
He actively works against Wukong's correct assessment. He feeds Tripitaka's blind spot.
So how does Wukong react to that?
Oh, Wukong fires right back. calls Pigsy a lump of raw food, basically calling a blockhead a brute, and accuses him of being heavy on lust, light on life, forgetting righteousness for profit. Says Pigsy's being fooled into basically finding a son-in-law for the demon.
Meaning Pigsy's desire makes him easy prey for her trick.
Exactly. It's a really sharp takedown of Pigsy's character flaws.
So you've got this huge argument, Wukong seeing the truth, Pigsy clouding the issue. What does Tripitaka do?
This is the surprising part initially.
Yeah.
He actually sides with Wukong, tells Pigsy, leave her alone, let's move on.
Really? After all that?
Yeah. Wukong is thrilled. He says, good, master has a destiny. Like, okay, maybe he gets it this time.
Huh. So they start to leave her there.
They do. They proceed forward, leaving the woman tied to the tree. It's almost like a moment where things could go right.
But you get the feeling that's not the end of it.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Because the demon is not giving up.
What happens next?
We get a glimpse into her thoughts, her true motive. It's revealed after they leave.
Okay. What's she really after?
It's Tripitaka himself. She recognizes him as a virgin cultivator with undiluted primal yang.
Primal yang, like life force.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pure, potent spiritual energy built up over lifetimes of cultivation.
Mm.
And she explicitly thinks she wants to combine with him.
Combine, like sexually.
Yes. To drain his essence, his primal yang, and the goal, to become a great perfected immortal.
Whoa! So this isn't just about a meal, it's about achieving immortality, ultimate power for her.
Precisely. Tripitaka isn't just potential food, he's the ultimate spiritual prize. That raises the stakes considerably.
Okay, so she's furious. Wukong messed up her plan.
Absolutely livid.
What's her next move? She's still tied up.
It'll tie it up. Ugh. But she doesn't need to get free physically, she uses good words.
Good words.
Yeah, like persuasive, manipulative words. Carried on a fair wind so only Tripitaka can hear them.
Sneaky. What does she say?
It's incredibly potent. She basically calls out, Master, if you don't save a living person, how can you sincerely worship Buddha and obtain scriptures?
Right for the conscience.
Exactly. It's not just a plea anymore. It's a direct challenge to his entire mission, his spiritual identity.
She's twisting his own beliefs back on him.
Perfectly. She's implying his whole quest is hypocritical, meaningless even, if he abandons someone seemingly in need.
Mm.
It's brilliant in a demonic way.
Mm. And this raises that big question about, you know, what is a good deed? Can it be manipulated?
Absolutely. Is compassion always the right response?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it might jeopardize the greater goal or when it's based on deception. She forces Tripitaka into this terrible bind.
So does Tripitaka hear her?
He does. But interestingly, Wukong, Pigsy, and Sandy all claim they heard nothing.
Hmm. Only Tripitaka hears the plea aimed right at his weakness.
Seems like it. And his reaction is immediate. He stops his horse, changes his mind again.
Oh, no.
He insists, we have to go back. We have to save her.
Why? What's his reasoning now?
He actually quotes her words back, and then he adds that famous saying, saving a life is better than building a 7-story pagoda.
So he's now elevating saving her, this one potential life, above even acts of great merit like building a pagoda, above getting the scriptures.
It seems that way. He seems convinced that this act of compassion is paramount, more important than anything else right now. It's an astonishing reversal.
What does Wukong make of this? He must be tearing his hair out.
You can practically feel his frustration boiling over. He says something like, when Tripitaka gets good-hearted like this, he's incurable.
Ah, like it's a disease.
Kind of. Wukong tries to reason with him, reminds him, Master, think of all the demons I've killed to save you on this journey.
Good point.
Yeah, he basically asks, why is this particular life suddenly so precious that you'd risk everything for it when you know it's likely a demon?
Makes perfect sense. But Tripitaka
stands firm. Quotes another proverb back at Wukong. Do not fail to do good because it is small. Do not do evil because it is small.
Doubling down on the principle of universal compassion no matter what, even against Wukong's clear sight.
Exactly. He's locked into that mindset now.
So what can Wukong even do at this point?
He kind of hits a wall. He sees his master's, stubbornness, his unwavering, perhaps illogical insistence. He basically throws his hands up. He says he cannot bear this burden.
The burden of responsibility or the consequences.
Probably both. The responsibility of trying to protect a master who won't be protected, and the inevitable disastrous consequences of saving this demon. He knows arguing further will just make Tripitaka angry.
So he gives up arguing?
Yeah. He essentially says, look, you want to save her. Go ahead. I won't stop you. It's almost resignation. I wash my hands of this.
Wow. That's a big moment for Wukong, too. Usually he'd fight harder, maybe even knock Tripitaka out again.
It feels like a moment of sheer exhaustion with his master's blindness on this specific point.
So what does Tripitaka do then? He's got the green light, sort of?
Incredibly, he tells Wukong, the one who sees the truth, to just sit down. Wait there.
Seriously, sit down.
Yeah, and says that he and Pigsy will go back and savor themselves.
Pigsy, the one Wukong just accused of being fooled by lust.
The very same. Despite all the warnings, all the evidence, Tripitaka is determined to follow his compassion. Immediately tells Zubaji, go untie her. He thinks he's doing a really good deed.
Of course. Classic Tang monk.
Exactly.
Yep.
And the text even says, the woman happily follows him out of the pine forest. So far, so good, you might think.
Yeah, Tang monk must be feeling pretty good about himself, right? Perform this selfless act. But then Sun Wukong, he reacts with this immediate kind of unsettling cold laugh. That's a pretty strong reaction, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's instantly jarring. And Tang monk naturally challenges him straight away. Like, why are you laughing?
What does Wukong say?
Well, his reply is just pure biting sarcasm. He says, I laugh at you encountering good friends when you're lucky and beautiful women when you're unlucky.
Oof. Okay.
Yeah, it perfectly sets the stage for the, you know, the deeper conflict here. And it's very unique perspective. It's quite surprising, actually.
So Tang monk must be, what, indignant?
Completely. Why? He defends himself, points out, look, I've been a monk since birth. I'm on this sacred mission to the West to get scriptures. You know, he's not seeking profit or worldly gain.
Right.
So from his point of view, how could his luck be down? It makes perfect sense if you think about his very pure-hearted perspective.
But this is where things get interesting. You mentioned Wukong's unique perspective.
Yeah, this is where the dynamic really shifts. Because Wukong, who we usually think of for his, like, brute force and magic powers.
The fighting.
Right. He suddenly comes out with this incredibly sophisticated and, frankly, pragmatic warning. He presents this very clear, almost legal perspective on the dangers of traveling with a young, beautiful woman.
Legal from Wukong. That's not what you expect.
Not at all. It's not the kind of threat we usually hear from the Monkey King, you know.
So what are these dangers? What specific fears does he actually outline?
Well, he lays out these very specific, very earthly fears. He says, look, if they encounter bad people, his words, that get taken to court, they could be accused of adultery or, the text says, poo.
Okay.
Or even abduction. These aren't monster attacks he can just beat with his staff, you see.
Right. These are societal problems, legal traps.
Exactly. And he doesn't pull any punches about the consequences either. He outlines these really harsh repercussions for each of them. For Tang Monk, he warns, he could lose his monk certificate and get beaten to half death.
Wow. Serious.
For Zubaji, maybe exile, the word is Wujing. Sha Wujing, he'd be implicated too. Kuwei is the term used.
And Wukong himself. Surely he can handle it.
Well, that's the thing. Even Wukong, the great sage equal to heaven, he admits he wouldn't be clean. He wouldn't be able to argue his way out of it.
Huh. So even his power has limits when it comes to human law.
It seems so. It really highlights that, you know, even these supernatural beings are kind of subject to human society's rules sometimes.
But Tang Monk, does he buy it?
Nah.
Yeah.
Not really. He's still the idealist. He dismisses Wukong's concerns. Basically, he says saving a life shouldn't bring trouble. And then he makes this bold claim, if anything happens, it's all on me.
Oh, dear. Noble, maybe, but...
But maybe a bit naive in this situation, yeah. As Wukong immediately points out.
And this leads to another argument, right? Wukong says he's actually harming her. How does that work?
Yeah, this is where Wukong delivers another really sharp counterargument. It completely flips the script. He tells Tang Monk, you're not saving her, you're harming her.
Harming her? By untying her.
Well, his reasoning is quite profound, actually. It's a really critical insight from the text. Wukong argues, look, if she'd been left tied up, starving, yes, she would have died. But she would have died with a complete body, as he puts it, returning to the underworld. A swift sort of whole end.
Okay. Harsh, but I see the logic.
But now, he says, Tang Monk rides this fast horse, travels like wind. But the woman... She has small feet, difficult to move. She just can't keep up.
Ah, right. The practical problem.
Exactly. And the danger, as Wukong sees it, is if she gets left behind, she could be devoured by wolves, tigers, leopards. And that, Wukong argues, would truly be harming her life. A much more brutal, drawn-out, terrifying end.
That's a powerful point. It forces you to ask, when does saving someone actually put them in more danger?
Right. And it clearly hits Tang Monk. The text says he admits Wukong is right. And actually asks him for a solution. It's a moment of surprising humility from the master.
Okay, so Wukong has a solution.
Well, Wukong, being Wukong, first jokingly suggests Tang Monk carry her on his horse.
Huh. How does Tang Monk react to that?
He immediately balks. Says, how can I ride with her? You know, propriety and all that. Classic Tang Monk reaction.
Okay, so if he won't carry her...
Then Tang Monk, desperate, suggests Baji carry her instead.
Oh, I can see where this is going. Wukong must love this.
Oh, he does. He delivers this classic line, proclaims Baji's good fortune has arrived. And then he teases him, suggesting his long snout would be perfect for scheming private conversations while carrying her.
Oh, Baji must have exploded.
Pretty much. The text says he's beating his chest, jumping up, emphatically refusing, says he'd rather take a beating than carry her. And he accuses Wukong, as usual, of always framing people.
It's great character comedy. Really feels like them.
Absolutely. It breaks the tension, but the problem remains.
So what's the compromise? Who ends up doing what?
Tang Monk, ever the mediator, makes the final call. He decides he will walk slowly with the woman, and Baji will lead the empty horse.
Ah, okay. A practical, if incredibly slow, solution. Everyone walks.
Yep. Though Wukong, of course, can't resist one last little jab at Baji, quips that Baji now has a business deal, or maybe a task, of just leading the horse.
Always has to get the last word in. So does Tang Monk justify this slow pace?
He does. He quotes an old saying, a horse travels 1,000 miles, but cannot go by itself without a person. Basically explaining they'll all travel slowly together, find an abbey, a monastery, maybe just a home where she can stay safely.
And Wukong agrees to this. Finally.
Finally, yes. Wukong agrees, and they all proceed together. It seems like, you know, for now, they've found a kind of fragile peace.
Okay, so they have a plan, albeit a slow one. They set off again.
Right. With this temporary solution, the group gets back on the road. You've got Tang Monk leading Shen Meng carrying the luggage, Baji leading the empty horse.
Poor Baji.
And Wukong holding his staff, leading the woman. So they travel, but only for about 20 or 30 li, not very far, and dusk starts to approach. And then they spot something.
What do they see?
Looks like a grand building complex. The text describes towering pavilions and halls. Instantly, there's this sense of hope, right? Maybe this is a sanctuary.
And Tang Monk, I bet he's relieved. He probably thinks it's an abbey or monastery.
Exactly what he suggests. A perfect place to rest for the night. And Wukong agrees, says, yeah, let's hurry. You can feel their relief.
Mm.
But Wukong's caution is still there, kind of simmering under the surface.
How so? What does he do?
Well, as they get closer, he tells the others, hang back here under this willow tree. He'll go ahead himself to arrange lodging. And significantly, he alone holds his iron staff, still restraining the woman, maintaining control even now.
Hmm, interesting. So he goes ahead, but Tang Monk follows eventually. What does Tang Monk find when he gets to the gate?
Yeah, Wukong's caution.
Mm.
It turns out to be justified. Tang Monk goes up, pulls open the gate, and is just immediately hit with this wave of sadness. The place isn't grand at all at close. It's dilapidated, leaning, and scattered.
Oh no, so the hope just vanishes.
Completely. And what's really striking here is the stark contrast between that hope they felt moments before and the scene Tang Monk actually finds. The writing paints such a vivid, almost poetic picture of total desolation.
It sounds quite moving. What are some of the details?
Oh, it's just heartbreaking. You have these silent, long corridors, a desolate old temple. There's moss in the courtyard, overgrown paths. It says the only signs of life are fireflies flying like lamps and frog sounds replacing clocks.
Wow, that's evocative.
It really is. Tang Monk is so moved, he actually starts shedding tears.
Yeah.
The imagery is incredibly powerful.
What else does it describe?
Well, it goes on. Dilapidated halls, broken bricks and tiles, crooked beams, broken pillars. It mentions the front and back are covered in green grass, and there's a dust-covered and rotting kitchen. Just a picture of utter, complete neglect.
Goodness. It sounds like no one's been there for ages.
Pretty much. The signs of disrepair just keep coming. A collapsed bell tower, a drum without skin, broken glazed lamps, faded golden Buddha statues, our hots just fallen over, east and west.
Even the statues?
Even Guan Yin and the goddess of mercy is described as ruined into mud, willow vase fallen. It's like the divine presence itself has just crumbled away there.
That's chilling. What else?
The text adds this chilling reality. There are no monks during the day, but foxes stay at night. You hear the wind sounding like thunder, and it signals a place where tigers and leopards hide. Not safe at all.
Definitely not the sanctuary they were hoping for.
Not even close. The final details are just miserable. Walls all fallen, no gates, and the big bronze bell on the ground, no bell tower. It just completely shatters any expectation of peace or shelter. They've stumbled into a truly forgotten and probably dangerous place. Tripitaka. He goes through this two-story gate, but the description. Well, the bell tower's collapsed, the drum tower too.
Fallen down. All that's left is this one copper bell, and it's half stuck in the ground.
And Tripitaka, being Tripitaka, he gets quite poetic about it. He touches it, notes how the top half is white as snow and the bottom indigo blue.
Yeah, that's just the weathering, right? Years of rain and being buried. Copper does that.
Exactly. And he starts thinking about, you know, the Taoist who first melted the copper, the smith who made the bell, all long gone now.
Mm-hmm. It immediately gives you the sense of decay, of history, abandonment almost.
It really sets a mood.
Mm.
But it also, like, sets up this theme of, well, things not being quite what they seem.
That's a great point. The decay is the first impression, but it's not the whole story.
Right. Because as he's having this moment lamenting the bell, his voice, which is apparently quite high-pitched, it startles someone inside. Suddenly, this Taoist priest pops out.
Okay.
And he doesn't say hello. He picks up a broken brick.
Oh, no.
And smacks the bell. Bang.
Wow. What does Tripitaka do?
He freaks out. He falls down, gets back up, trips on a root, falls down again.
I mean, poor guy.
And he yells at the bell, thinking it's like, become a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Then he turns on the Taoist, calls him an ugly and dark ghostly demon.
He really lays into him.
Oh, yeah. He even starts bragging about his disciples, you know, the dragon subduing, tiger taming ones, basically threatening him.
Huh. So much for the serene monk at that moment.
Right. Yeah. But the Taoist, he quickly apologizes. He's like, whoa, hold on. I'm just the temple attendant.
Okay. So a misunderstanding.
Totally. The Taoist says he heard this weird noise Tripitaka's lament and thought it was an evil spirit knocking.
Hmm.
So he hit the bell to suppress it before coming out.
So he was scared too. That's actually kind of funny. It perfectly shows that appearance versus reality thing again.
Exactly. Fear on both sides. And this theme just gets stronger as they go inside.
Okay, so the Taoist leads him in.
Yes, and Tripitaka is just struck by the contrast. The front, he notes, is extremely shabby.
Yeah.
Utterly dilapidated.
Right, as we established.
But then they pass the third gate and the back part. It's extremely neat and tidy, like night and day.
Really? What's it like?
Oh, it's gorgeous. Blue brick walls with colorful clouds, green tiles, a glazed hall, golden Buddha statues, white jade steps. The main halls are glowing, radiating energy. There are descriptions of colorful clouds, painted flowers, jadeite, even fragrant wind and painted drums. It sounds incredible.
So, like a hidden palace almost.
Right.
Why the difference? Why let the front decay like that?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. The Taoist explains.
Okay.
He says the mountain is full of demons and strongmen, basically bandits.
Right. Common problem.
And these bandits, they rob people when it's clear. And when it's cloudy or raining, they hide out in the temple's front section.
Oh, I see. So they just took it over.
Pretty much. They push over Buddha statues to sit on them, burn the temple wood for fires.
Mm.
The monks were too weak to stop them.
That's awful. So what did they do?
They adapted. They basically raised funds, donated again, the text says, and rebuilt the back part, making it secure and beautiful.
Hmm.
So they have these clean and mixed sections. The Taoist calls it a Western affair, meaning like a practical arrangement.
That is fascinating. It's a survival strategy. They sacrifice the public face of the temple to protect the sacred core.
Exactly. Zenhai Chanlin Temple, that's its name. It's this amazing mix of, you know, spiritual dedication, but also incredibly practical, almost shrewd management.
It really speaks to how institutions, maybe even people, have to make tough choices to survive in difficult environment. It's resilience, but in a very unexpected way.
Definitely. So Tripitaka is taking all this hidden splendor, and then he meets the head monk.
Another key character, right?
Yeah, a Lama monk. And he's described very specifically. He wears a felt and brocade hat. Big copper rings in his ears.
Okay. Distinctive look.
Wool blend clothes and these striking white eyes like silver. He's rattling a drum, muttering scriptures that sound foreign to Tripitaka.
Right. A lama. So different tradition, perhaps. Yeah. How does he react to Tripitaka?
Instantaneously. He sees Tripitaka and thinks he's a Luahancha, basically. A living saint who's come down to earth.
Based on what? Just his appearance.
Seems like it. The text mentions Tripitaka's clear eyes and brows, broad forehead, ears touching shoulders, signs of spiritual attainment, apparently.
Ugh, okay, so appearance matters here too, but in a positive way this time.
Totally. The Lama is all smiles, approaches Tripitaka, and starts doing these very intimate gestures, twisting his hands and feet, touching his nose, pulling his ears. It's meant to show closeness, warmth.
Wow, quite a welcome. Almost overwhelming, maybe.
Could be. It certainly shows how much weight that initial perception, based on looks and bearing, carries in this world. 1 minute you're a demon, the next you're a living saint.
Hmm, yeah. That's a really good point. Physicality and presence are read so intensely.
But then, this initial warmth, it shifts a bit. The Lama gets concerned.
About what?
About Tripitaka traveling alone. He's like, it's dangerous out there. Miles and miles, mountains, caves, demons. He notes Tripitaka looks, well, kender. Not cut out for it.
Understandable concern, given the bandits they just talked about.
Right. But Tripitaka just calmly reassures him. Oh, don't worry, he says, basically. I have 3 disciples with me.
Ah, the famous disciples.
They pave roads across mountains, he says. Build bridges over water. They protect me.
And how does the Lama react to that?
He's shocked. He's like, disciples? Why did you leave them outside? There are tigers, wolves, bandits, ghosts out there.
He immediately orders his attendants, the little llamas, to go fetch them.
Quick, invite them in. And what happens next? This is a classic Journey to the West humor.
Oh, I bet. When they meet Wukong and Baji.
Exactly. Ah. 2 little llamas run out. Ah. The first one sees Wukong Monkey and is so terrified he just falls right over.
Oh, dear.
Gets up, sees Baji Pigsy, and bam, falls over again.
Uh-huh. Poor kid.
And scramble back inside, totally panicked. They tell the head llama, Grandpa, disaster. Your disciples aren't there. It's 3 or 4 monsters at the gate.
Monsters? Oh, the descriptions must be priceless.
They are. One with a thunder god mouth. That's Wukong. One with a pestle-like mouth, Baji. One with a blue face and fangs, Sandy. They even mention the girl Tripitaka rescued, calling her a girl with oily hair and powdered face.
Wow. So just pure terror based on how they look?
Completely. But Tripitaka, he just laughs. He's like, no, the 3 ugly ones. Those are my disciples. The girl, we saved her earlier.
He's so matter-of-fact about it.
He is. And then he tells the Lama, you better hurry and get them, that thunder god mouth one, Wukong. He gets impatient. He might just break in if you wait too long.
Huh. That's brilliant. The contrast between the perception terrifying monsters and the reality, yeah, they look weird. But they're the protectors, and Tripitaka's just used to it.
It's the core humor of the group, isn't it?
Yeah.
How utterly strange they look to everyone else.
Absolutely. It never gets old. So do the little llamas manage to invite them in?
They do, but they're terrified. They go out again, kneeling tremblingly to ask them in.
Oh.
And Baji, of course, has to make a joke.
Yeah.
Asks Wukong, why are they so scared of us? Suggests it's because they're ugly.
He knows it.
And Wukong's retort is perfect. Let's just tidy up that ugliness a bit then.
What does that even mean?
Well, Baji takes it literally. The text says he tucks his mouth into his bosom, trying to hide his snout.
Oh my goodness, that visual.
Isn't it great? So then they make their entrance. Baji leads the horse, head down, trying to look less piggy. Sandy carries the luggage. Wukong brings up the rear with his staff, keeping an eye on the girl.
Quite the procession.
They go through the ruined outer parts into the nice inner temple, stable the horse, put down the luggage, meet the head llama, get seated.
And presumably don't cause too much immediate trouble.
Not immediately. In fact, about 70 or 80 little llamas come out to start preparing a vegetarian meal for them.
Wow, quite the welcome party, despite the initial scare.
Yeah, the self-awareness of the disciples, yeah. Baji's little trick, it just adds another layer of humor to their arrival.
It really does. It shows they have personalities, even a sense of humor about their own appearances.